This work of predicting the evolution of hemagglutinin, but the evolution of the influenza, because it goes with the virus. The co-workers are Robin Bush at UCI with me, and Catherine Bender and Nancy Cox at the influenza branch of the Centers for Disease Control. And they're all the people who did the work. I'm just talk about it. And my topic is influenza. And it's a question, why doesn't the immune system stop all this and kill the virus off? And for that, I'm going to have to introduce you to some immunology at a crude level. This is the virus, what we're thinking about. It's got 8 genes, each on a different piece of RNA. It has a lipid coat on the outs, on the exterior, hanging through are 2 proteins, one a neuraminidase and the other a hemagglutinin. The hemagglutinin is the major source of humoral control, immunological control, the thing to which the body makes, the human body makes antibodies to. And the way that system works and what we think is happening in this process is that the evolution is dominated by an attempt of the virus to escape immune selection. That is, the virus comes in, it looks foreign, the immune system mounts an attack, which takes some time to get going, but eventually it'll shut down and kill off all the virus in your infected self. But in that interval, the virus in turn will mutate, and some of those mutations will be effective in reducing the immune ability of the hemagglutinins to be recognized by the antibodies. So we'll start off with the biological system, of which there's a virus in the cell. And this virus, that could also be thought of as the hemagglutinin, but either way, this represents a receptor binding site. And down here on the surface of the cell, of mucosal cells, is the receptor. The virus binds to this the receptor, and that binding tells the virus then that this is what this is an appropriate cell. Now, the cell didn't make the receptor in order for the virus to get in. But cells have normally many receptors on their surface designed to help the communication of cell to cells within the body, not designed to make it recognizable to the virus. But the virus nevertheless utilizes the ability of the to bind to different receptors to discriminate what cells it's going to infect. Notice the receptor doesn't have an exact match to the hemagglutinin will bind, the receptor binding site doesn't match exactly the receptor. The next stage, of course, is that having gotten in there, the host raises antibodies to the virus. Just a notation for the chemist, the receptor is a sialic acid. There are many sialic acids of different structure that can be used, but only one that's appropriate for this one. The antibody binds to the virus or to the hemagglutinin to the surface. It can bind anywhere on there, not just in the receptor binding site. In this case, though, I may have shown it in the receptor binding site. The purpose of this binding is simply to label the virus so that the phage system, the macrophages, will recognize this is something to engulf and destroy. That's all. So all this is a label. That's all the antibody does. It labels it. Of course, if it's labeled over here, it might still contact the cell. and do something beforehand. But if the antibody is to the receptor binding site, that would be more efficient because now the virus cannot bind to the cell. Yes.
So they're all potential receptor binding sites.
Yes, yes. And as long as it finds one, then when it attaches, I might have mentioned the neuraminidase cleaves this sialic acid, which makes the membrane more fragile and make it easy for the antibody to get in. So what happens then is the virus mutates and it fills in this little patch here, like here. This is just a cartoon, a description, but the idea is basically the virus mutates, and that mutation has to have some effect, such as now the antibody cannot get into the place where it used to get into, and so that antibody is prevented from doing the job it would otherwise do, namely labeling the mutated virus. And of course then that mutation, it prevents the antibody from getting in, but doesn't prevent the virus from binding to the receptor site. Richard?
I'm thinking that the antibody response has to have a big blind spot, you know, corresponding to self-recognition, you know, that it has to be designed to not recognize anything corresponding to, similar to the host body. So if I were a virus, I would try to evolve in such a way as to mimic molecules in the host body, and therefore I would be completely invisible to the antibodies.
There are viruses that do that, but not all. You'll have to speak to these viruses in order to get the answer to why. They decided, they're unusual in that basically they're trying to outrun the immune system by changing faster than the immune system can keep up. So it's like the Red Queen in Alice in Wonderland who tells Alice that they're on a treadmill and that you have to run as fast as you can in order to stay where you are, which is, in the case of this virus, just one step ahead of the antibody system.
The ones that are able to become sort of like self, how are they ever defeated? And it seems like a really good strategy.
The general strategy of predators is usually to find some accommodation with the host, because it's to the predators, This is refers to all kinds of antibiotic things and, that produced by other organisms to get in. That it's a common enough thing for the virus to try to, not so much hide, although it does that too, as to be innocuous. As long as it can reproduce, it doesn't care, of course. Reproducing in itself is not entirely innocuous, but if you can get it down to that point, like this same virus in the birds does not evolve rapidly. I'll show you a tree in a little bit, but if you plot the year of isolation versus the distance from the root, you get a nice straight line. It's nice, very nicely clock-like. But if you do the same thing, not for hemagglutinins in humans, but the hemagglutinins in birds, the birds have a lot more of these influenza viruses. Then you discover that in the time span over which we have data, like 50 years, there's not a significant rate of evolution to observe. Whereas the human ones and other vertebrate ones, like horse and pigs and those are the two we have the most information besides birds. They're going at about 1% per year change in their sequence. And so it's evolving about a million times faster than, say, mammals are evolving. But when you do the same plot with the bird sequences, the slope is not significantly different from zero. So they've clearly adapted into the birds in some fashion. And that fashion seems to be related to the sialic acid that they recognize. Bird ones recognize a different sialic acid conformation. They also infect not the respiratory tract like human influenza do, but the gut. So they're infecting mucosal cells of the gut. The physiology of the mucosal cells of the gut is that they will be dead in a month or two or so. I mean, you're always sloughing off dead cells, mucosal cells, in the intestinal tract. Well, you do it on the surface of your own skin also. That's also being replenished. And so it's clear that even this virus adopts a more benign attitude with the birds, because the birds get the ill, but not very, and doesn't. And so it's not trying to escape from.
There's some billion viruses that switch which sialic acid receptors they go after, and they do that sometimes in humans. Do you know why in the birds they don't opportunistically infect the lungs occasionally or the brain or that sort of thing?
They may opportunistically do, but their survival depends upon their acquiring a mutation along with it, which they sometimes do, so that they can recognize. It's more often that they infect and then mutate rather than mutate beforehand and then infect. But. Okay, so there's the mutated virus, and it is capable of still infecting, but it, as you saw, this mutation, which I happen to put there, but it could be anywhere. The mutation effectively gives it a bit more life. This basically is sort of the summary of what I've just said. The virus comes in and it gets into the cell, and it has viral hemagglutinin. That's what the HA is for, and it comes down. It infects a mucosal cell. Most of the viruses that come in, of course, are not may well be, if this individual has seen human influenza viruses before, it will be resistant to many of the viruses that it gets in that sneeze, and so they'll die off. The green means success, and the red means killed off. The human mucosal cell will now make a lot of cells, a lot of viruses, on the order of 1,000 per cell. And if they have an average of one change per replication, in one replication, then if it's an average of one, then e to the minus one is the probability that you will get no change, and one minus that is the, and e to the minus one is about 37. I put 35 here for rounding off. And therefore, 65% will be mutated, some of them two or three times. Of those, those are not mutated are going to be taken out by the immune response that has been already established from its infection. Now, not in one cycle of, it takes several cycles, but for that to be true. But that means that all those that don't change are going to be wiped out by the immune system. Those that do change will largely have ineffective mutations, and they will be lost too, but a few of them will be okay and can go through again. And going through again is simply what this arrow does. This is simply a small-scale version of this, and it just keeps doing it on and on and on and on. So that's the process, and the important thing to take away from it is that you have a method that is, the virus has a method of trying to escape immune surveillance. It's mutating very fast. It's incorporating mutations at a fairly high rate of speed that you can measure. And what I'm going to be doing this for is that this is the important driving force for the, I will maintain, for the evolution of the influenza virus. And so that we know where most of the mutations that are being selected are going to fall. They'll fall in here, although there is some that will fall in neuraminidase as well. But this is the major, hemagglutinin is the major player in this response. David? I'm sorry?
Is there a role for T cells in this?
For B cells?
T cells.
T cells, yes. They're the macrophages are T cells, aren't they? Maybe they're B cells. But anyway, which cells are responsible is not something that I'm absolutely clear on, so I better not mislead you by.
Rounds of replication are the viruses going to have before there's a real antibody amplification?
If it were a naive individual had never seen it before, I don't know, but if you get a burst size of 1,000, then you get infect one cell, and then the burst from that can get you 1,000 new ones. It won't take long for it to get up to the point where you're sick and your immune system hasn't yet accomplished it. I don't know how many generations, that is, viral generations are required. Yes?
You get some virus, but you didn't get sick. Is your immune system trained during this process? If it just routinely killed, recognized and killed, or in order to be trained, your immune system should be undergo illness.
I don't think I understood the question. I'm having my hearing is not the greatest in the world.
I'm sorry. If during influenza epidemic, I got some virus, I didn't get ill. Somehow my immune system fought.
Mm-hmm.
Does my immune system change adaptively to this particular?
To the new one. If your immune system that you already got on the basis of previous contact with viruses is still capable of recognizing shutting down the virus, this new version that you've gotten, the immune system is unlikely to train itself to add that to its repertoire. It will kill it off, and it doesn't normally do anything new. In fact, what it's more likely to do is to change, if it can, the rate at which it will respond to it. The first time, your response is delayed for the amount of time it takes to generate the antibodies. But what happens afterwards, the next time around, is that it gets triggered right away. And if you get if you had a mutation in that triggering device, it might be selected for. But largely, the response is that you get it almost immediate response, and that's why you don't get sick. The previous ones, you don't have to develop the antibody. You've already developed, and they're what are called memory cells. And the memory cells contain the ability to turn on and multiply right away.
Interesting. I know Alan Turlson used to talk about that in terms of getting vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
He would say if you don't want to get sick this year, the best thing is not to have gotten a vaccine last year.
I'm not sure that's true. I think that it has to do with the appearance rather than the reality. Physicians, of course, are in contact with this a lot, and they're not particularly ill all the time. And I think it's because they keep their titers high with respect to the antibodies. And they're kept high because they're always coming in contact with some kid who sneezes in their face. And the result is that they seem like they're immune to these attacks, and I think it's because they're always getting more and more. So I've always felt myself that even before I developed this theory, which I shouldn't call it a theory, this hypothesis of immunity, is that I've not made any effort to stay away from people who are ill, and I still get ill once in a while. I'm not totally immune, but my health record seems to be considerably better than average with respect to these infectious diseases. But I think it's just a matter of, in Perelson's case, it would follow that if you got last year, what was it? Now, if you didn't get it last year, you were better off than.
Well, if you didn't want to get it this year, yeah, you were better off not to have gotten it last year because you'd have a better response to the immunization.
Yeah, well, okay. Interesting idea. We have something like 400 sequences in this that we're going to study. And so the number of trees that are possible are more than we can handle. And so we're looking at just heuristic methods to find good trees. And we've found one that's pretty good, and we use it for all of this. We have tested how, we have done other trees when we start the cycle over again and see if we can get a tree as good as the one we got the last time. We kept the best one of these. But we also examined the best ones that were not as good as the ones we eventually kept to see if the answers that we get studying this particular tree are conforming or congruent with the answers that we got using the other nine. There were 10 trees altogether that we looked at, and the other nine all gave the same result as the one you're going to see. So that the issue of, well, you may have missed the best tree, we almost certainly did. I think it's guaranteed, given the number of trees, that we did not find the best tree. But we found found some that were good enough that we could actually apply our methods to it. This is the tree. There are 357 sequences, all 987 nucleotides long. There are no gaps. It's easy to the alignment is trivial. What you see are the lines that indicate that between this point and this point, any sequence isolated in 1993 falls in this region of the tree between here and here. And the same is true for all. So you can see there's overlap. But what you can also see is, it should be a very shadowy thing that you can hardly tell, but the names of the sequences that all died off are all there in quiet solitude. The sample sizes are in red, and you can see that it looks like there's a change in the rate of evolution between here and here. That's spurious. It has to do with the sample sizes. These things take, because there are over, well, here's 44, 32, 49, 66, 69, the sample size is down here. So it just takes that much more space. Each one requires its own little space on the tree. And so these are spread out compared to these, and so it looks like the rate changes, but it isn't rate. The rate is very, you take and plot the year of isolation of any of these isolates against their distance from the root, which is down here, and it's a beautiful straight line. It's the best molecular clock that anybody knows about. You can, if someone gives you a new sequence, almost invariably tell what year it was isolated just by seeing where it falls on the tree. Not perfect, of course, because there is overlap, but nevertheless, its distance from the tree is a good shape. Now, the big thing to notice is this heavy dark line. We divide the sequences in this tree into three categories. If they fall on these branches along here, those branches are called the trunk of the tree. And these are just little isolates that may have several members of it, but they die out. In fact, if we take the rate at which this is evolving, we know how fast they are. We can ask, how long ago did this isolate, was its ancestry on the trunk? So, and that's essentially the average age of the individuals that don't make it. And that's about a year and a half. So they go to extinction fairly fast. And if they fall on a tip branch, then we just call those tip branches. We have the three T's. In between the tip branches and the trunk are what we call twigs. And so we got these three categories, trunk, twig, and tip branches. And we are interested in the mutations that occur in all of these, of course. And so this is our reference tree. This is the one that we picked to do our analysis on. Any questions on that? Yeah.
And when you sort of one point got your Smokers Ball of in 1966 influenza types. You can bet there's only really one that will be one lineage which will be still in existence in 2006.
I don't know if I want to go that far, but what we're going to do is to say, all right, our task is, given all the things that were isolated in 1993, can we tell which one became the progenitor of the lineages that were isolated in 94? So that the test of predicting evolution, in this case, is an attempt to predict which of the strains that were isolated in 93 gave rise to the subsequent members. In this case...
So you were at all worried that the ones you had in 96 came from some lineage which you didn't sample at any time?
Well, I'm not sure what it would mean to, if it's here. I mean, there, it has to be from something we have.
85, there were 19 lineages, but there were 200. The ones that survived in 97 come from one of the lineages which you didn't sample.
Well, let me phrase it differently and see if I've still got the same idea. Here is a sequence that, as far as we know, died out here, but maybe we just never sampled its descendants for 10 years, and it actually is the ancestor of one up here. Is that right? That if we had been able to follow the history of this one, which is unsampled for 10 years, that we would have found in 95 that its descendant was very close to this. That's taking two different routes to get to approximately the same place. The answer is, I have no fear of that. This is strictly divergent in everything we measure. Things get farther apart. I have searched for things that converge rather than diverge, because part of my little hobby horses that I ride include a distinction between homology and analogy. Homology meaning common ancestry, analogy meaning convergence because of selective pressure to similarity that wasn't there in their ancestry. So I've looked for convergence, and apart from some very rare examples like ribonuclease, is it from Carol Beth in Rochester, where they're seeing the same changes in ungulates and in a subset of primates called langurs. And they seem to have had a modest but nevertheless detectable amount of convergence after their common ancestor, once in the ungulates and once in the langurs. Both of these are related to foregut fermentation that has occurred in leaf-eating animals do that. I can do that. Yes, Richard.
I'm a little bit confused in terms of predicting the progenitor of the next of the next year. I look at, for instance, 93. 93, you sample a whole wide range of things, and you're trying to say, okay, what should we target ourselves for 1994? And the answer is 94 is even broader and seems to include everything that was seen in 93.
In the range, that's true.
Right, right. So it seems like if we were to try to target 94, that it's not that everything in 93 seems to carry out in 94.
One of the things that you can do with these trees is at any given horizontal line, which represents a descent, vertical lines only are to give separation to the sequences. Any horizontal one, you can rotate freely the entire tree, so that if I were to rotate across here, then this would go to that side and this would come this way. That's awkward to have it do that, of course. But as a result, if you carefully attend to the which ones you go which way and which ones you rotate and which ones you do not rotate, you can make some of these some of these spreads narrower, right? So that if this is due to this, then if I rotate it, I can bring it up here and cause this branch to be less far. So you shouldn't make any particular or draw any particular conclusions about what the meaning of these ranges are, because they are in some sense quite arbitrary and capable of being altered by rotations about these axes.
It just though seems that in general that it doesn't.
Why don't we wait until I tell you what I'm going to predict more precisely and how I'm going to do it more precisely. You had David?
Yeah, I had a question. One thing that does interest me when I see this tree is that there's just a couple of places where there are these persistent double lineages mm-hmm. in that tree. And I'm wondering, for example, 88 to 93, and then there's another one, 93 to 95, the last little bit. Do those
kind of
mix completely around the world and there's
not any geographic? Oh, there's no geographic sense. I did what I thought was clever at once, but maybe it's not so clever, is that you can do these at the level of amino acids. And so you put A is for alanine and G is for glycine and all that sort of thing. And I said, I wonder if I can show evidence that these, the spread of the viruses is from Asia outward. And the way I thought I might try this is I changed the meaning of A and G from alanine and glycine. I don't know why I had anything for G, but A became Asia, and F became Africa, and then N was North America, and S was South America. And so I did, accepting well, it was another tree. It wasn't exactly this tree, but one very much like that. I just had a sequence of length 1, which instead of being real amino acids, were amino acid letters standing for continents. And that means then, as you're looking along here, all of these are Asian, but all of these are European, then that's a change at a branch right in there, which constitutes a movement from Europe into Asia. And so you can then count how many mutations, quote mutations, that is geographic transfers occurred and in which direction they occurred. There was no statistically significant difference to expectation, where expectation was that you can go in all directions with equal probability and any particular place could go whenever it wanted. So that. There is no geographic relationship to be observed, and as you might expect from what I just said, it is also true that there is no particular geographic bias such that in any particular year you're sampling from in 1 year from Asia and the next year from Europe and the next year after that from North America. Any one of these where the sample size is reasonably large, 86 might not be one of those, they're coming from all over. And it's deliberate sample. It's non-random. It's highly prejudiced with respect to China, especially the southeast area of China, because although the general flow of viruses from one continent to another is proportional to the amount of each that you've gotten. It is, what was I going to say? Well, the important point is that there, at any given moment, there might be some all of these may have come from, I was talking about the bias. The CDC collaborates with places. We spend a fair amount of money on hospitals and laboratories in China for their surveillance, because historically it has seemed that the big pandemics, and these are not pandemics, these are epidemics. Pandemics are when the whole world gets wiped out at high levels because there has been a complete change in the gene structures for hemagglutinins. In the birds, there are about 15 different hemagglutinins. They all have the function of recognizing some sort of receptor on the cell surface that of the cells they would infect. And again, And damn. I thought I got enough sleep last night. Anyway, what happens then is that there, if one of these new ones comes in, this one's called H3. If a new one comes in and it's, say, H5, and H5 did come in Hong Kong not so long ago, then what can happen is that everybody in the society is naive with respect to this protein, this hemagglutinin. And so it's like you have, no matter how much vaccine you've gotten before, it's irrelevant because you got vaccinated with H3 or H1, and this is H5. And those, all of the great pandemics, like the one in 1918, which is where H1 came into the population, and it just wiped out because the population was totally naive. They hadn't seen H1 before, and it just killed millions of people all over. And those are pandemics. These are, in fact, when the Hong Kong thing happened, I thought it was the end of my research program, because if it took over the world, there would be no more H3 for me to study. Because the usual thing that happens is when the new one spreads, it just wipes out everything else. There's been one exception to that, and that was a laboratory isolate that escaped from the Russian laboratories. The Russians were making an attenuated vaccine, rather than a live one, but was supposed to be relatively innocuous. They used, this was in like 1950s, they used an isolate from 1930 and used all the genes that were from 1930 except for the hemagglutinin, which they managed to make an isolate which had the current 1955 or 60 somewhere, that current one, and that was what they were hoping to get the immunological response to, figuring all the rest would be all right, but it was H1. And then in the process of doing this, it got out somehow. And so there is now circulating at the same time with the H3, which is circulating here, an H1, which when it got out of the laboratory was capable to sustain itself. So we actually have the very rare circumstances for influenza genes that we've got two co-circulating, and in our vaccine we now put in one representative of H1 and one representative of H3, so that whichever one you contract, you'll have some resistance to. Any other questions about that? Well, there are, I don't know whether you can say they compete or not. Co-infections are known to occur. And once you get co-infection, you might think that you can reassort the genes. That's not very common. But in any one year, it may be that H1 is more dominating in that year's episodes than H3, and vice versa, and that probably has to do with the evolution of the virulence that goes along with the evolution of the hemagglutinin. So.
I know that they talk about swine flu. Where do pigs go on this? I mean, what are their roles? Is this the other animals besides humans?
When you have these pandemics, some of them occur by virtue of a change of the neuraminidase rather than the hemagglutinin. And so that any of these things can only be traced back to a certain amount of time. But what is curious is those are two of the genes. The other six genes tend to remain the same. It's as if whatever's evolving in our population, the switch, the reassortment that occurs with viruses from the bird population occur only at the level of the hemagglutinin and the neuraminidase. The other ones trace all the way back to a common ancestor. And if you do this with the pig sequences and the human sequences, the best date is 1918, which is the year of the great pandemic. And when H1 came in and replaced whatever was before it, I don't know what was before it. and which is curious, but is associated with a really neat kind of interesting observation, which was that farmers normally have livestock shows and so forth at state fairs, county fairs, and even national fairs. And there was a big national fair in Iowa in 1918, and the flu got into the, it was probably brought, of course, from some other place, but it spread like wildfire through the population of animals there. And of course, the farmers picked up those who hadn't brought it and nevertheless acquired it and took it back home to their flocks. And so it was a particularly auspicious occasion that almost certainly the origin of the pig versions, but not of the hemagglutinin or the neuraminidase, but of the other six genes, all go back to that time in 1918 when the flu was introduced into the United States. It was called the Spanish flu at the time, so they thought it was from Spain. I don't think that's true. I think it's an Asian virus again. But most of these pandemics do seem to come out of Asia. And the and even if they don't come, like the Hong Kong one, which was H5, that one turned out that it didn't infect humans readily. It didn't, the passage was not did not work. Given enough time, it might have with accumulating mutations. But I think there was something like 15 known cases, and there isn't a single epidemiological observation that links any one of them to any one of the others. They're all isolated epidemiologically. So getting rid of all of the fowl that were infected in the markets seemed to have stopped it. So my research program can go on. Anything else? All right. So basically what we're going to do is say, we have a method which I haven't told you about, but what we're going to do is say, all right, we have all the information through 1985, which is this part of the tree, and can we use it to predict which one of those isolates in here gave rise to the individuals that were in 1986. So, and we can do this for 11 different years, and we make a, and then ask, is it right? Because we know where it went. This tree tells us. As long as all of these have died off, could one of these not be sampled and reappear up there? Suppose it's possible, but I don't believe for a minute the odds are that it was important enough to stay that it could stay hidden through all of this. And, anyway, so that's what we're going to do. We're going to take all the information up to some year and try to predict where the trunk would go as we would see it in the following year, knowing the entire tree. So it's a retrospective prediction, if you like. Okay. Now, how do we go about doing that? First of all, you need to know that a couple of fundamental things, that some mutational changes are silent. The third A mutates from A to a G. It still codes for lysine, and that has no effect on what we call the phenotype being not the gene products, but, well, the products, all right, but on what selection can take easily take place on. If the mutation is in the first position instead of the third, it changes it from lysine to glutamate, and this is called non-silent, and it's something you can expect to see. Now, we look at the data for that tree, we can ask and count how many were silent and how many were non-silent in the entire tree, how many mutations, and that turns out to be something like about 55% of the mutations are silent and 45% of them are non-silent. This is going to be important because what we're going to ask is, if there are positions which have a significant excess of non-silent over silent changes, then we might suggest that that is where positive selection to change is occurring, because change is what the hemagglutinin needs to do in order for the virus to escape the immune surveillance. So we're saying there is a pressure for non-silent changes, but they don't have to be. Not all the positions necessarily have to have that. We're going to look at positions individually and ask what the probability is of there being a like that. Now, this is an example of supposing you had 10 mutations and 8 of them were non-silent and 2 of them were silent, then just the binomial type expansion, so that you get a power of, this is non-silent, so that would be to the 8th power. This would be the silent, so that would be this to the 2nd power. A is the total number of observations, n plus s, and so that's 10 factorial. P is the probability of non-silent, which I said was 0.45, and in these data. And Q is the probability of a silent, which is 0.55. And then this is 2 factorial, or 8 factorial times 2 factorial. And you do all those computations, and you discover the probability that you would have observed this in any one sample is 0.023. We use a 0.05 cutoff for doing this, and we got these results in here. We got 27 positions that had probabilities that were less than 0.05, and these are the total number of mutations. These are the number of non-silent, and this is the number of silent, and you can see that there's a fairly impressive list. Now, there's something you have to do statistically here. There's a problem of what's called multiple tests, and the question is, how do you get around that? What we did was to do the following. First of all, there is a requirement. If you wanted to get a value of 0.05, you have to have at least 4 mutations in the position, right? Because if you only had one mutation, the probability of whatever it is about 0.5. If you only have 2 mutations, then the extreme case is 0.25. If you got 3 mutations, the extreme is now 0.125, right? So that you've got to have 4 before it's possible to have a value less than 0.05. So we threw away all the positions that didn't have 4 changes in them. And then we looked at all of those that had at least 4. Actually, there's some 3 zeros here, but we decided 3 was just too small, and we threw them all away. And then we said, all right, how many positions were there to look at that had 4 mutations? That turned out to be 97. Let's call it 100. If you look at, so that means that's the number of multiple tests we were doing. We did 100 multiple tests, and we expect, by chance, 5 of those to be there by chance, not by design of the selective process. And so what we did, and of course that's be distributed on either side of the distribution, we're only interested in the ones that have an excess of non-silent. There were none that had an excess of silent ones, so it's clear that something is very special is going on. So we took out the 5% that was required. We took out 5 from the 2 ends of the of the distribution, and we took the ones that were closest to 0.05, which seems to be obviously, if something is 10 to the minus 8, that's not something that in 100 you'd expect to be part of the normal distribution, but one which was close to 0.05 you would expect it. So we removed from the 0.05s those that were closest to 0.05, and I think one can show here's a 4-1, 0.04 for example, that one was removed, and that way when we did that we got down to the second table, which are the 18 positions that we contend are the most likely candidates to be under positive selection. And the... Yes?
This is 987 bases long, and they're all in the first 270 or...
No. There's 2 ways of counting. One is to count nucleotides, and the other is to count codons. The silent non-silent is a property of what's happening at the amino acid level, and so it's 329 is the range of the numbers. But not 987. Okay? Good question. All right. So these are the ones, and here's one that's really gone wild. It's got 21 mutations in it. 20 of them are non-silent. most people are not prone to argue that this is non-random, right? Yeah, Richard.
I'm a little bit uneasy about the statistical.
It might well you be. I've shown this to many statisticians.
Yeah.
And they all say, I've never seen that done before. I don't. It seems sort of all right, but I can't give you any reference for which it is done. On the other hand, I wouldn't reject the paper. I would just require you to be very careful to note that there's no formal theory behind it.
Well, the thing that I'm a little bit worried about is what you're doing is you're calculating the probability of exactly that ratio of how many synonymous versus how many non-synonymous.
Right.
And obviously, if you have 10 changes, then the probability of any one, any combination, 3, 1, 3, 7, 7, 3, or whatever. Right.
Okay. Let's say it slightly differently. If you get something like 10, 8 out of 10, you get 8 and 2, and that's remarkable. 9 and 1 is even more remarkable, and its probability ought to be added into the 10, 8, and even 10, 0 should be added in, and therefore raise the probability. But we did that. None of these none of these would be affected by virtue of adding in the probabilities of more probable events.
Right. Okay.
Or less probable
events. That's one thing that I wasn't that worried about. The other thing, though, is the fact that what you're doing is you're throwing out all of the locations where there aren't very many changes.
Oh, yes.
The probability of any arrangement of synonymous changes would be much higher for those particular locations. So it seems what you're doing is...
Wait a minute. Why do you think the probability is not 0.45 and 0.55?
Oh, it is 0.45 and 0.55. But for instance, if I have two changes, yeah, then a 2-0, a 1-1, or a 0-2 split are all very, very likely. And
yes, so that's why I throw them all away.
Right. But the fact that you're pre-throwing away those locations with few changes before and then using what's left to estimate how many, what is the repeat measurement problem, makes me a little bit worried that maybe the repeat measurement problem should include not only the ones that you keep, but also the ones that you pre-filtered, because by throwing those out, you're throwing out ones that would never end up having low probabilities in the first place.
As long as the distribution of mutations is like 0.545 and 0.55, irrespective of how many mutations have occurred in that position, I feel I'm able to say that I will only look at those where it's possible to have a value of 0.05. Now, I cannot prove that as being acceptable statistically either, but that's what we did. But I think the proof is partly in the pudding. If the predictions that we make are successes, if they're failures, they may be due to all the problems that you're talking about. If we successfully predict the result, then that verifies that what was done at least was pushing us in the right direction, even if it was like assumptions of normality when you can prove they're not normal, but you use them normal anyway. Right? I think they fall in that category. David?
Wondering, they must have been like in the range of 4-1 to
4-1s. We kept them. No, yeah.
You know, I'm wondering what the nature of those extra five that you didn't choose to include in your 18. You know what I mean? You just said you did the multiple corrections.
Yeah. Well, what I did is, from the list of the 27 that you saw on the previous one, from this list, we threw out anything that didn't have 4 in it. Like this 3-0, that has a probability of 0.03, but the sample size is small, and we just felt uncomfortable having looking at those with 3. So we threw away all those with 3, and then we threw away the 5 that had the largest values from what was left. So 0.40, which is 4-1, that was thrown away, and there's another 4-0. Here's another 4-1 that was thrown away, We threw away 9 of those.
So here, number 16, there's a 4-4 with a probability of 0.01.
That was kept. This is 4-0. This is the total number. These are the two numbers you want to look at, 4 and 0.
Yeah, but the next slide, I thought it had a different number, a different
probability. All right, let's see. That was 160. Maybe that was thrown away. I don't see a 160 here.
Okay, the 4 zeros are now at 32.
Uh-huh. This is 162. That was turn. But that makes sense. But this is 4-0 and it's 0.0119. And whoops. And this is 4-0 and it's 0.032. I can't explain that. I think I know what the answer is. That all of these things have been calculated many times as we poured through, and I think they were calculated at different times. they remain the same, though. The ones that we selected remain the same. Okay. Now this is probably a good time to quit. But okay. This is the three-dimensional structure, and all of these things represent amino acids in those positions of the three-dimensional structure that we said were under positive selection. Down here is where it comes through the membrane. There's this little knob, and there's a lot. It looks like there's more than 18 up there, and there is more than 18 in one sense. This molecule is a trimer. So there are really 18 times 3 equals 54 ones in here, because this one will be over here and here and somewhere over here. So the 18 sites are represented on each of three copies of it. And you can see it's up off of the surface, because the surface is down here. And this is where the antibodies can attack it and bind it. Okay, that sounds like a good place to stop and have the respite before you go on. We go on and actually tell you how we made our predictions. Now, the way I envisioned trying to do a prediction was to say, if we have the a set of sites, in this case 18 sites, at which there is positive selection to change, and the change in those positions are responsible or necessary in order to keep the virus alive for the next generations, then possibly if we looked at all of the isolates from one year, like 1989, and asked for each isolate, how many amino acid replacements have occurred in your lineage since you were at the root, and thus everything's going to be relative to the root. And you say my prediction is that the one which has the most changes in these positions is the one that will win the race and be the progenitor of future generations of virus. Hmm? Any questions on that? Yeah, Terry.
Do you care what it changed to?
I don't care what it changed to. I might really care if I had the ability to know how to treat such a difference. But
it can't change those.
No.
What if it is exhausted? It just burns down. It burns quick. It burns down and that's it. There's no more changes. You assume that the number of possible changes would be sort of unlimited, or at least extrapolated. But what if there is a limit?
We have no evidence. Well, we have at least one position where it had 20 amino acid replacements. There doesn't seem to be any limit as to the total number. There are limits clearly apparent in some things which we'll say have mutated a fair number of times, but it's always either glue to asp or asp to glue, for example. And clearly their space of possible changes is limited in some fashion. But I'm just asking which one got the most. There may be some average rate, but it doesn't really make much difference that some rates may be small and others large.
And there are several omnipotent points which could change to anything, right?
I don't know if there's a position that could change to anything. When I was studying superoxide dismutase under a covariant hypothesis, one of the things that one needs to do is like the Jukes-Cantor thing, except for amino acids, you'd think instead of 3/4, it would be 19/20 and 20/19 in the other thing instead of 4/3. If you do that, the fit is very poor to the data. That's not these. I'm talking about superoxide dismutase. The fit is very poor, but you can make the fit very good if you assume that it's not 20/19 or 19/20, but something like 3/4 or 4/3, which immediately tells you, on average, you're only allowed 2 or 3 or maybe 4 alternatives, that the rest are not really available to you because the data fit well if you use... I mean, it's as if you would rebel if someone said, use Jukes-Cantor on protein data. I mean, Jukes-Cantor's for nucleotides, it's not... But it turns out that because of the limited number of alternatives that effectively you can go to at a position, the effective number of amino acids, at least in superoxide dismutase, I have no reason to believe it isn't similar in others, is somewhere around 3 or 4 on average. Okay, so you got the picture then. We're going to, for each thing isolated in 1980 whatever or 1990 whatever, we're going to count how many changes have occurred in these 18 positions, and the one that has the most changes in it is going to be our predictive estimate. Our estimate of the isolate that is going to be the future progenitor. There are other sets you might use, and we tried these because, you know, if we can find things that do better than the predictive set that I've described, then clearly there's a better way of looking at it than the way I'm looking at it. And for example, you could just say, well, the races to the Swift, there's no particular ordering that things go, but if you mutate more, you're more likely to have a favorable mutation, and therefore you win. So you say, instead of picking the 18 positions that using mutations in the 18 positions to predict this, you use how many mutations altogether. It's like using 100% of the mutations and the positions to count. Or you can pick them randomly. You just pick out 18 random positions. Terry?
I forgot in the first half, the data set you used to extract these 18 changes, were they from all of the known data from 81 to...
Yes, 87? yes.
So, and those 18 were sort of evenly distributed? It could be that
I didn't check.
Only half of them were there. And then so these changes could be time-dependent themselves.
They could indeed be time-dependent.
But they're not.
But I don't know that they're not. I don't know that they are. I haven't asked to see if these positions appear only in the first half of the position or the second half of the evolutionary history. Didn't occur to me to do that.
I mean, in 2010, maybe it's not the same thing changes, but maybe there's some other changes out there.
Oh, absolutely, and it wouldn't surprise me if that were true. One of the things we hope to do is get enough data so that we can see if the same predictive set works as well on the first half as on the second half, but we don't have enough data to do that yet, but that's on our list of things to do when we have more data. Okay. Anyway, so there are these different sets that you might use to do the predictions and see if they affect any. Under positive selection on the off-tip changes only. Let me explain off-tips. These sequences frequently, historically, have been grown in some sort of cell culture. Kidney cells seem to be very popular. Canine kidney cells are used, and some other kidney cells. The most commonly used one are eggs. Eggs have a different sialic acid than the mucosal cell recognition site. When they isolate the virus and they grow it up in these embryonated eggs, then there's the possibility of mutations occurring in the egg, which are due to selective forces other than the kind that we're interested in. So what we did in this set is that we just eliminated all the information on tip branches. We just threw them away, saying, that's where eggs are going to, that's, anything that happened in the egg would be in a tip branch. And therefore, we can throw them away. We had enough data to throw them away. And so that's what I've described then. This is what I'm actually doing. They could be under positive selection using the tip changes. We've tried that. Under positive selection using all the changes, tip plus off tip. Receptor binding site positions. Antigenic site positions. There's a whole literature on which positions are supposed to be under antigenic stimulation or susceptibility. And in fact, if it's being driven by antigenic sites, this is the one that I figured, if this doesn't work, this will be better than it, or whatever it is. This could easily be better than that because it focuses specifically on antigenicity, whereas my method is only looking at whether or not it has changed a lot in one of these sites. And positions that undergo host-mediated change in the egg, there are positions like that that are known to be changed in the egg, and then randomly chosen positions. This is the tree you saw before, and what we're doing here is noting that we've broken it off here at 1994, I think, at 93-94 test tree. So this is the tree that we got using only these data. It does not equal this because this was gotten using all the data. This was using only the data up to here, and so the details that are in here are not the same as the details that are in here. But this shows where different isolates map into these groups. Those groups were determined as the as things that were distinguishable from other groups. So there was what we thought was a significant difference between these two groups, and we said, "All right, we'll just pick that. We will set these groups." There are obviously a lot more alternatives that are possible. Let me blow up that view. And you can look at something like, what we said we wanted to have happen is that for all of these data, whatever was the highest group in this thing going up, that is what I'm trying to define here, a success for you, that a success would be that if the highest group from any of the highest group in which any of these fell was, say, group 10, then the prediction was success if the one that I took out of here was in group 10, but if it were in group 9 or 8, it was a failure. So I've got a predictive site. It could fall in any one of these groups. We know it cannot fall higher than 10 because none of them fall higher than 10, but it must fall in 10 in order to be a success. And if there's more than one group, more than one isolate that has the same predictive value by the test, like it's had 25 well, that's more realistic number. It's had 11 changes in its positively selected sites. There could be two that have different mutations, but they both had 11. In which case, for us to be a success, both of them had to fall in the highest branch. Now, this is sort of important. I want to pause and ask, do you understand what I've done? Now, the question is, you might have the question of how do we get those groups? And the groups were, let's see if I have that.
I don't really know what you mean by the highest group or highest branch here.
Oops, went the wrong way. These groups are determined by, they're not just a single isolate. They're groups of isolates that we're saying are, for this test, are equivalent. And that equivalence was set about because of things like the following. We did this in 10, in 9 other cases, 9 other trees that we got, because we wanted to know if our results were affected by that. And one of the things that happened is that if you have a, see if I can you see this? Supposing this is the tree that you're getting, and here's A, B, and C. And these could have other branches below them, but these are the three groups in here. It may happen that when you do the analysis for the tree, that this distance here is zero, right? Now, until I put that zero in there, it said A branched off before B and C, and then B and C branched. But if this distance is zero, that's a false statement. This distance is zero, they came effectively at the same time, and I don't know which is higher up the tree, whether it's A or B or C. So anything that was a zero got collapsed and made, in this case, instead of having two, it would make three, and it can make four or five. But we put them all together. We also said we did 10 different trees and asked if there were any difference. Now take the case where this is not zero. It's non-zero, but if B and C were together apart from A only 60% of the time, we said that's too low. We shouldn't pretend we know that these came later than this, that this divergence came later than the A split, when only 6 out of the 10 trees that we looked at did that. So we would amalgamate positions like that. The result is, although they are not amalgamated here, they're shown in all their gory detail, is that these groups fell out as things that we could be confident of. But those are what we had to predict. And so if we had sequences only up to here, then maybe the highest group would be 3. And to be a successful prediction, we had to have the sequence that we said had the most mutations from the root to that point in time was our selected isolate that we had to test to see it had to come in the highest group at any time. Did that clear it or not?
What would be the random success rate? In other words, if I took the various isolates in 94 and asked randomly how many of them appeared in group 10?
We've asked for any given year what fraction of the sequences fell in the upper group. The highest value we saw, there's one where 47% of the isolates fell in the upper group. So you could hardly go wrong. You flip a coin and do only marginally better. But that was really high. We got another one down around 20. Most of them are around 10 or less. We have one which is only one sequence fell in the upper. And in fact, that one sequence, this is picked in this particular year. In this particular year, the 93-94 test, there were positions as high as 10, but none higher. And there were sequences that were in 9, and some were in 8. And I think there were some in 7 as well. And this particular year, it isn't obvious from this, but there was only one isolate that was in group 10, and that turns out to be Shandong. Shandong turns out, interestingly enough, to be our predictive sequence. Shandong is farther from the root as measured by amino acid replacements in those 18 positions than any other sequence isolated in that year. So that's a success, and it's a very improbable success because it's the only one in that one. I don't know how to combine these things because each year that we did it had a different set of values for the probability that it would fall in there. I suppose you could multiply the probabilities, and that would be fair. But anyway, that's what we did, and this happens to be a year in which we got a success.
So wait, so what was the...
The what?
This was by... So you listed all the different ways of measuring the Shandong?
Yeah. Oh, Shandong was done by my method, the one that says you count the amino acid replacements that have occurred since the root in the hemagglutinin sequence of each isolate. And this isolate was the one that had the most amino acid replacements since the root. So that was the one we predicted would give rise to the root, and we call it a successful prediction because it is in group 10, and that is the highest group to which it could belong if it were isolated in 93-94. All right? Okay. Okay, the important thing is that you can tell the difference between a slightly larger number in bold than a smaller number that's not in bold, right? Because what we've done is to label 11 years across here, and if the prediction was successful, it tells you what group it belonged to, and it tells you by a large bold number. So this, the prediction fell in group 2, and that was the largest group we had, the highest group we had, and so that was successful. It predicted 2 again in 87, and 87-88, and 88-89, and the largest group was actually, the highest group was 3, and so those are unsuccessful predictions. And these are different ways of assigning a method to get the prediction. The one at the top is from my method. That is my thing of saying it's the amount of change in these 18 sites that's crucial. The rest of the sites can be ignored. And what you can see is that 9 of these 11 cases, we got the right answer. And we'd like to... We'd like to believe that possibly the reason we did so poorly down in this region, and we'd have to throw that out as well for the if we had an argument, is that the sample sizes are small. When the sample sizes got larger, we got the last 8 predictions in a row correct. So then we went to the antigenic sites. The one I said looked like that would be, in my mind, would be the best alternative to that if this doesn't work. And this AB doesn't stand for antibody. It stands for region A and region B. The antibody antigenic sites on the surface are broken into 5 groups, A, B, C, D, and E. And this is group AB, which is widely believed to be the more important regions for the change. And you can see they got 7 of the 11 correct. I don't have any reason to believe that this is not... I don't have any reason to believe that this is a significant difference. I don't know how to make the test. However, this group has within it many of the sites that are in my group. And so I asked the question, what if we take those under positive selection and remove them from the antigenic sites and see what turns out? And what happens is it got the right answer in the first year, and it never got the right answer again. So being antigenically favored sites doesn't give you any power. That is, or said differently, I believe the reason this did so well is because of the presence of these positions in that group. And if we took them out of that group, that it ceased to do any good. The next one was... CDE, that was the group, the other 3 regions besides the AB, and it didn't do well at all. It only got 1 right answer. The receptor binding site was interesting. It got 5 out of the 11, it didn't get halfway. I just sort of ignored that. I didn't try to say anything special about it. Then getting positions that change the most rapidly. Going fast was helpful. It got 6 out of the 11, over half. And again, if we took away, because there's overlap, if we took away the possibly selected codons from this and replaced it by other codons, so it still had the same n equals 18, it only got one right answer. So again, whatever success this has seems to be due to the inclusion of groups that I had in my set. I don't think they are the same, but they have properties in common that make for an overlap. In that is, a position can be, it can simultaneously be in an antigenic region AB under positive selection by my definition and going very fast.
So the intersection of those sites from those three different definitions is large.
Well, the intersection could eliminate a large number of those positions. I don't think there are many positions. I haven't asked the question, so I haven't made the count. But I don't think there are many positions that are simultaneously present in this group, and this group. I think there are not a large number. Of course, 18 is the best you could do under any circumstance. But I'm sure it's pretty less, it's considerably less than that.
So you gave a couple of different models for excluding the distance on the tip branches, only the tip branches and all these.
Yes.
And when you say positive selection, is that the entire branch?
No, this is only for the off-tip branches, twigs plus trunk.
Twigs plus trunk.
Mm-hmm. And if we just chose, this is the number I was telling you about. There's that 49% of the members of, let's see, how do I, 49% of the possibly selected group fell in the highest level, so that the probability of getting it correct this particular year is 0.49. Actually, my method didn't get it right that year. But it had a probability of 0.49. The next one was 24.6, and that was another early year in which the correct prediction was shared by a large number of positions. And but it goes down to 0.1, 0.6, 0.8. There are a lot of very small values, and they're especially small in the later years when we had a lot more data. So as we get more data, the probability of getting the right answer by chance is going down, but we're predicting very well in those years. So that was from random selection. This is the percent of the isolates in the upper group. I misspoke about that. But the numbers are comparable, except these are smaller. So the probability of getting the right answer in 8 out of 11, I think, is rather. This n equals 18 mean we chose 18 positions, the 18 fastest positions, in this case, since it's minus positive, the 18 fastest evolving positions, excluding those that were members of this group.
And n equals 20 would be far. So you've just taken out two positions, and they made a huge difference.
I've taken out two positions?
Going from fast to
fast. No, I could have taken out more than two, because if this... if I'd taken out five, I would then I would add three more, right? So that it would be 18. It isn't that it naturally that there were two, and that's why it went from 20 to 18. That there were two in there. We wanted that number to be 18 because that number was 18. So we took the 18 fastest positions that were not in this group. That doesn't have to be a two. David. Huh? We haven't done it in neuraminidase. That's on the program to do, but Right now, we're looking at influenza B instead of influenza A.
Under your model, roughly speaking, part of the reason your sites could be narrow is if there's positive selection of the neuraminidase, the total number of positive selected sites could be better on some lineages just because it has a better neuraminidase.
Conceptually, that's a perfectly rational alternative or addition. But I haven't done that. Okay, let's look at just a little bit more of this. This is the tree again, but now it's got labels on it. And it's got two kinds of labels, circles and diamonds. The diamonds are, and the other thing is they're color-coded by year, so that if there's the same color, it's the same year. And what is shown with the diamonds, as I said, are the predictive tips under positive selection. That is the ones that I was predicting would be the progenitors. If you just use the random set of positions, you just draw 18 at random and do that, then they are shown with a circle. So what you see is that here's the prediction, and here's where random is. Here's the prediction, here's where random is. Here's the prediction, here's where random is. Here's the prediction, here's where random. In every case, the prediction outdoes random by a very large amount, and has to believe that there must be, I must be selecting something right for the predictive set. Now, having chosen the predictive one, I've taken the easiest case, the case where the difference is the most extreme. But you get similar kinds of things with lots of screen differences, no matter what you use, and the predictive one looks better, as you can imagine from what you saw in the previous slide. Another version of that is instead of it being the random here, the predictive is still as before, but the circle now represents the strain that was chosen to make the vaccine out of. And this one should include the other one as well. But you see, this comes down to here, prediction, vaccine, prediction, vaccine, prediction, vaccine, prediction, vaccine, so forth. So as you go down, I guess I could make that a little. So as you go down, what you see is that it looks as if I'm predicting a year ahead of time where the strain that will be used in the vaccine. So it looks as if something very useful might come out of this. However, I've misled you a little bit deliberately just for the hell of it. It's an unfair comparison. It's an apples and oranges thing. I'm predicting progenitorship. The World Health Organization is predicting virulence. There's no reason why those two things have to be the same. And it could easily be that for the purposes that they are trying to achieve, namely estimating virulence, that their their selections are better than my selections. That is, being up here instead of down here doesn't mean that they didn't make the correct decision in putting this into the flu vaccine for 94. Right? Yes?
How much feedback is there to the flu vaccine? I mean,
how much feedback?
It sort of makes sense that you predict something which is not being vaccinated against because things which have been vaccinated against are less likely to survive.
The question is, does the vaccinating procedure affect the evolution? And the answer from every epidemiologist I've talked to says the numbers are insignificant with respect to the vaccine. Not enough people are getting the vaccine to have it make any difference. And I'm quite confident that's correct, not from my expertise, but the many people, the epidemiologists that I've talked to, they all say the same thing. That it's the elderly and the newborn that are mostly getting the vaccine, and the people and the elderly don't count anymore with respect to the future of the human population. They've already done their bit. The CDC, Nancy Cox is from the CDC, and she attends these World Health things. So she's made, from what I hear, made some use of these. I wouldn't do anything more if I were them than say, well, if we don't know whether to take this sequence or this sequence, then take this one, because that's, in other words, use it as a tiebreaker or something. Because I think it has some value. What we want to do, of course, is try to find out how we can predict virulence instead of ancestry. But we haven't figured that out yet. Richard?
Why not put both in? Is it,
why not what?
Put both in. I mean, is it generally one or the other, or are you generally getting
contact? The vaccine that you are now getting is trivalent, meaning it has three members in it. And it's got two A types, which is the worst type of thing, one for H3 and one for H1. The third member of the vaccine is from a type B, hemagglutinin. And the companies that make these vaccines don't want to change more than one a year. So the issue is really now, do we need to make a change? And if so, which one should we change? Not which two or which three, because it slows down the time. And to put more in would require not the same size of sample with divided into fourths, but a larger sample that gave the same amount of protein as before. Otherwise, you don't get a good enough response. So the people getting the shots start really complaining when you have a larger multivalent ones, because you still have to give a certain amount to get a good response, and so you've got so much foreign protein stuck in your arm that the people just rebel against doing it. David?
What portion of that tree did you use to come up with the set of 18?
The whole tree.
Okay, so the predictive set is based on the entire tree?
That is correct.
If you calculate the distance between the prediction and what's seen at the average distance, how is it comparable to the distance which is traveled by virus in this year?
How does it compare to what?
This distance between vaccine and prediction, how it is compared to the distance traveled by virus?
Oh.
Yes.
If I take a group down here, it'll be from all over the world. So it doesn't make it doesn't make sense to say compare this one with this group on the basis of the distances, because they're from all over the world, right? Where distance is the number of amino acid replacements in the selected sites. One can say how far this group is from that group, but that's not a geographic, that's a phylogenetic question.
Huh?
How many years does it take to get from here? Well, on average, the distance is about 1 year. Richard?
But you could ask the question also, in 1994, what would have been the best vaccine? And I'm wondering, by just asking what was the most virulent strain that year, I'm wondering if there's any way of getting some idea of where the most virulent strain was each year on a graph like this.
Well, presumably, this is telling you that, right?
And just explaining that it's worth understanding that these are all highly selected sequences, that is, they usually take these things based on their antigenicity and differences in their antigenicity in selecting which ones to sequence. So they're not, the number of sequences in a particular group you see is not necessarily based on the prevalence during that year.
That's right. There's something called a hemagglutinin inhibition assay. And what they have they have antibodies to each of these types, all of these that they've chosen, right? And when a new virus comes into the lab, they grow up enough to find out what the degree of reaction is to the antibody to, say, 94. If it reacts as well, then it's very much like the isolate from 94, and therefore it gets ignored. But if it has very little cross-reactivity, that must be because it has evolved a lot of changes in the sites recognized by the antibody to this, and therefore it is a candidate for sequencing and a candidate also for being selected. The selection process involves other items such as, does it come from Southeast Asia? There's a bias to picking a site if it comes from Southeast Asia. How fast does that group seem to be spreading? So that if you look in this group and you say, this has a lot of geographic range in a very small time, because the dates are recorded for these, not just the year, but the day and the month. And so they can ask, how long a time did it take for some reaction to get from China to Australia or something like that? And so they take anything that looks like it's spreading rapidly to they take that into account also.
Is there any way of just pointing out, is the most virulent strain in 94 somewhere on that graph, and it's possible to locate exactly where it is?
Well, it's possible the most virulent strain wasn't isolated, so you have to ask about the most virulent strain among those that were isolated, right? And I would say that these come close to being what they believe are the most important with respect to virulence. So I was just using these as markers for the estimate of virulence. David?
How much of this tree would you need to get those 18, or you like that you follow this tree for another 3 or 4 years, or you like that they get another 2 or 3 sites, just by chance, you just have to recognize
that? We're doing that experiment, or that analysis. We're not actually doing it at the moment, but we're collecting the data so that we can do that. We think that's an important thing to show. Anyway, let me just give a quick pitch for this makes me very delighted. I'm excited about this work for two reasons. One is that it might do some good in terms of the practice of medicine, although it's not finished in that respect, but it has that potential. The second is on a more theoretical basis. Evolutionists don't predict evolution. They reconstruct the history, the past, and try to tell you, well, this is how it happened. Prediction is something that evolutionists have stayed away from, and I think for very good reasons. The next mutation that's beneficial, there are probably lots of beneficial mutations in trying to predict and count them from a human organism, for example, seems to me not very likely. So that, except for trivial predictions such as, well, if you give me a new antibiotic, I'll predict that your hospital will have a resistant strain of bacteria to your antibiotic within 5 years or something of that sort. I don't think that's a very difficult prediction. Maybe you can do the same thing with pesticides in the field. But this prediction is based solely upon the history in that gene. I didn't look outside the gene. I had to have biological information from outside, because otherwise I wouldn't have had the selective set that I had. But the data for putting it into that mill all came from the history of this gene. And so it's sort of a first. Unfortunately, it's they're not going to be that I can foresee. Not many cases that will follow up on this, because there were special cases that are involved here. One is that immunological drive. Most times, the improvement is not going to be due to immunological drive. Secondly, even if it was, they'd be in different antibody positions and things of that sort, so that you wouldn't know where to look for these things. It requires that they go fast. I've got for this something like 30 years of evolutionary history. Since the mutation rate is about 1 million times that of mammals, it's the equivalent of 30 million years of evolution in most of the kinds of genes that we'd be interested in. So this is going to be limited to those that evolve very rapidly. And it also has to be one that gives this strange kind of a tree where you can tell who the winner is. If all the bifurcations come down to the tips and the tips are all at the same level, there's no winner. Whereas on this one, there's a winner. You can see the winners all the way down. So this is a special kind of case that is not a common case at all. And I guess it reflects the fact that the virus is trying to outrun the immune system, whereas most predators try to either accommodate or what have you. And you don't know how to figure it out. So it would be a lot more satisfying to me if this had great generality, whereas in fact it looks like it has very small area of generality. But still in all, it's a first, and I'm very pleased at it. So, and let me just say, getting 9 correct out of 11 in the last 8 in a row, I think says something to answer the doubters of the statistics. I threw away a bunch of sequences. Why did I throw those away? I can tell you why I did it, but is that statistically legitimate? I don't know. I can't find anybody who will tell me or who will work on the problem and try to show that it's not a bad idea to throw away 5% and use what's left as a guess. That doesn't mean I believe that we threw away the 5 that were by chance and that that the ones that were left didn't have any that should have been thrown away because they were by chance. Or alternatively, because they were not positively selected. But the set that we ended up with clearly has a lot of power to discern things in evolution. So, I don't know if you agree. Terry?
There seems to be a lot of underlying regularity that allow you to try to make a prediction. You mentioned this distance.
The rate of evolution is very constant.
What is it about this particular system that makes it so regular? I mean, usually I think a biological system is very hard to predict and so forth. I mean, you can imagine if we use this kind of method to say predicting to bet on the future of say dot-com companies, you know, all kinds of things. But what is it about the process here that makes it so regular?
Well, I think it has to do with the fact that the principal drive, the selection for this organism, is the escape of the human immune system. And so it has to go fast. Going fast, it almost has to keep up a certain rate just in order to survive. Although I can say that the rate along the trunk is not significantly different from the rate off the trunk, which was something I was wondering about. I can ask, what's the rate of evolution along the trunk? And I can ask, what's the rate of evolution that's off the trunk? Right? And they turn out to be the same. So the rate along here is not slowing down for any reason. The reason this didn't become the trunk instead of that is presumably this got more replacements that were useful to it than that, and that enabled it to survive and win. David? No, I haven't done that. Richard?
The one thing that I'm a little bit worried about is that you identify the 18 locations based upon the entire tree.
Mm-hmm.
And so your, which implicitly puts in information about the end of the tree, making predictions about the path. So for instance, in 95, you wouldn't have the information about what locations are going to vary faster between 95 and 97 or 98. Is there any way of looking to see at 95, given the information that we had at 95, if we were to identify those sites which vary fast up to 95 and look at those sites, that those would be good at predicting 96, you know, not using the information about the later transitions to identify the 18 sites?
I understand the paradigm you're saying. We haven't tried that.
I'm still confused as to why you really only get one progenitor path.
So am I.
It seems like if that was, it's keeping up like that, and at some point that the human immune system is going to run out, and there's nothing going to survive. This long period, you're only really getting one branch surviving. At some point, there becomes a real probability that everything gets wiped out to have this kind of structure. And if that's not true, then the virus must be doing better than that. And it seems surprising that you're not getting bifurcating lineages, and that eventually you have lots of virus lineages.
I get that question every time I give the talk, and I don't know the answer any better today than I did 2 years ago.
Part of the answer to that might be that this isn't an isolated system, and these viruses are competing, and there's going to be cross-reactivity to these viruses among one another. Right? So because if one virus variant spreads during 1 year, you know, it's going to build a plot of cross-reactivity to anything that looks like it. And so then the next year, something that looks a little bit different is going to be more likely to spread. That doesn't mean that at any one point that viruses were really in danger of collapsing, because with the step that they get a smaller and smaller population, then they get a more and more naive human population.
Competition, which means
that it's the competition of the
variants. The viruses.
It's the variants which is collapsing the effective population size, but that doesn't mean that the actual population ever collapsed.
Mm-hmm. But the actual population goes through fairly large changes in size, in numbers, not effective population, but because although it does go to the southern hemisphere during our summer, so that it's a winter phenomenon both, there's still time between when they peak and when we peak, when the total, when you don't isolate much virus in either area, northern or southern hemisphere. So that's just another part of it. What was your last comment? It was about, the business of using the whole tree to get the set. And that concerns me a bit, but what gives me some feeling that it's not totally illegitimate is the basis upon which the sets were picked. That is, although I used the whole tree, I didn't use survival or any of those things as the basis for selecting those 18. I asked only that they were getting more changes in that were non-silent, significantly more non-silent than silent. And that is not the basis upon which I say whether the prediction is right or not. So the information that I used to select the sets is not the information that tells whether or not their predictions are correct. And I think that creates a kind of independence between the two that, while I wouldn't say was absolute, I don't believe that, but I think it does mitigate the concern that that was the source of success. If everybody's gotten all their questions out, then maybe there's not a need for I'm willing to meet at 3:30 if there are people who want to ask more questions.
Should, do people want to meet again at a session at 3:30 or not as much?
Okay, well then, I guess.
Okay, let's not have a meeting at 3:30, especially since Holger is around.
Okay, thank you.